And joining us on Perspectives today is Lisa Genova. Lisa is a New York Times bestselling author. Her books include Love, Anthony, Left Neglected, and Still Alice, which is also a major motion picture now. Lisa Genova has captured a special place in contemporary fiction, writing stories that are equally inspired by neuroscience and the human spirit. A lot of you may not know this, but she has a PhD in neuroscience from Harvard and travels worldwide speaking about the topics depicted in her popular novels. She lives with her family in Massachusetts. Lisa, thank you very much for being with us here today.
Thank you for having me.
Now, the first thing that I want to talk about, because our listeners probably were not aware of this unless, you know, they read the jackets or read other things that are available online now, the fact that you have a PhD in neuroscience. Tell us about this. How did this come about? Were you always interested in becoming a scientist?
Yeah, I mean, that's where it all started for me. I had always wanted to do brain research. I studied neuroscience in college. Back then it was called biopsychology. And I went on to get a PhD in neuroscience from Harvard. I primarily did research on the molecular neurobiology of drug addiction. And I did brain research at Harvard and at Mass General Hospital and at the National Institute of Health. So I've always been fascinated in the brain and how it works to reveal our memories and thoughts and moods and desires.
And so
the funny thing is that I'm a novelist now.
Yes, that's what I was. What a great novelist that is, too. I was wondering, what you mentioned your dissertation, was it on drug addiction? Is that what you wrote about?
Yes.
What did you find out that perhaps, you know, because drug addiction is something that over the years has become very stigmatized. And now people are realizing that there are certain medications that work a certain way. And now we're starting to see a lot more people who are not necessarily addicted, but perhaps their body has been tolerant of prescription drugs.
Well, I studied addiction in rats. And I looked at the changes in gene expression that occur with chronic exposure to drugs like cocaine and amphetamine. And the idea is that the drugs are not addictive the first time the brain sees them, but with repeated exposure, they become addictive and there's withdrawal without them. And the drug is still the same compound. So what has changed is the brain. And so how has the brain changed to now become an addicted brain? And so I looked at changes in the gene expression and the proteins that are expressed in the neurons to make them behave differently after chronic exposures to drugs of abuse.
We're visiting with author Lisa Genova. Lisa, if you're wondering why we're talking about brains and drug addictions, the fact that we just have been talking, the fact that Lisa has a PhD in neuroscience, and you know her as the author of Love, Anthony, Left Neglected, and Still Alice, which has become a major motion picture. Her latest novel is Inside the O'Briens. It's a fascinating novel, and I don't want to use the old cliche, but I'm going to use it anyway. It's something that I could not put down, and I finished it in just a little over a day. So tell us, how did you switch from studying to be a scientist to become a novelist? Had you always kind of been interested in writing stories since you were younger, Lisa?
No. I mean, this whole career path has taken me totally by surprise. It began when my grandmother had Alzheimer's, and this was in the late 90s. I had already finished my PhD. I was at that point actually working as a strategy consultant for biotech and pharmaceutical companies. And I, as a family, we were taking care of her. And as the neuroscientist in my family, I was trying to better understand Alzheimer's and pass that education along to my parents and my aunts who were taking care of her. And I learned a lot of information, but it was all very scientific and clinical and geared toward the perspective of the caregivers. So everything was written by a clinician or a scientist, a caregiver or a social worker. And what was lacking for me was an answer to the question of what does it feel like to have this? And that was the question that kept coming up over and over for me as a granddaughter wanting to stay connected to my grandmother. What does it feel like? And, you know, I think having gone to a liberal arts college, my education was pretty broad, and I had an intuitive understanding that literature is a place where we can explore empathy. And that was the seed for the book back in the 90s was, someday I'd like to write a novel about a woman with Alzheimer's and tell it from her perspective, from the very first symptoms, to get an understanding for what it feels like to have it.
And is that how Still Alice was developed?
That's how Still Alice started, yeah. I mean, my life circumstances changed quite a bit, and in 2004, I was an unemployed, newly divorced single mom who should have gone back to either brain research or strategy consulting, but that sort of upheaval in my life at the time led me to sort of thinking about my life in a new way. And I asked myself if I could do anything I wanted and I didn't care what anyone thought of me, what would I do? And the answer was, I want to try to write that novel. So that was the beginning of everything. That's when I did not go back to work and I started writing Still Alice.
One of the things that people, I guess, if they've never read any of your novels, they are definitely behind, I don't want to say behind the times, but they need to read these because they're very, very engaging. And you deal with some situations, like you said, Alzheimer's, Huntington's disease. And it's not just about the disease. It's not from an academic standpoint. But you get inside the family. You feel what they feel. And I don't know if I should make this comparison. Perhaps I'm wrong. But in Still Alice and Inside the O'Briens, Still Alice, you're dealing with kind of an upper middle class family because of Alice is a professor. And then in Inside the O'Briens, it's kind of a middle class family because the man is a police officer. And I guess you're showing that disease does not see any border grounds or border lanes as far as money, careers, anything. If it's there, it's there. And the fact that this gene is there.
Right. I mean, anything can happen at any point to anyone. So with Still Alice, but there are reasons behind all of this. I mean, the goal with the stories are to make these really scary neurological diseases and conditions accessible. And you're right. It's not about writing about the disease. And it's not intended to be, a clinical text. They're supposed to be accessible stories. Oliver Sacks once said, when we examine disease, we learn about anatomy and physiology. And when we examine the person with disease, we learn about life. So that's a really important distinction for me, is these stories are about people. And so the choices are specific, and I'm always trying to tell the truth under the imagined circumstances. And so with Still Alice, I made Alice a Harvard professor because here she's going to get a disease that robs you of your language and memory and cognition. And if you're a professor at an elite school, that's where you've placed all of your worth and identity. So then she'll have to wrestle with questions of who am I now and how do I matter and am I still me if I can't remember, which I think are the questions that everyone asks. But the stakes are raised super high if we're looking at someone like a Harvard professor with Alzheimer's. And then with Huntington's, I chose the O'Brien family, an Irish Catholic blue-collar family from Charlestown, Massachusetts, which is a small neighborhood in Boston. And he's a cop because, telling the truth under the circumstances, if we're setting the book in Charlestown, this would be one of the things a dad in that neighborhood might be. He might be a cop. And I liked making this character a police officer because with Huntington's, you have a disease that is going to rob your ability to have control over yourself. And you become completely vulnerable. And there's no treatment and no cure. And if you're a police officer, you have to control every situation you're in. That's your job, is to be in control. And your job is to protect and serve. So there are, you have weapons to help you. You've got your training. You've got your gun and your badge and the bulletproof vest and your fellow officers. So here's this guy who has been used to being in control. and protecting and serving, and he's going to be now in a situation where he really can't control anything.
Now, it's interesting. We're visiting with Lisa Genova. Lisa is the author of New York Times bestselling books, Left Neglected, Love Anthony, Still Alice, and the most current one is Inside the O'Briens, which deals with Huntington's disease. In this story, as you mentioned, Joe is a police officer, and he relies on all these things that you talked about to do his job. But I think what really hit me hard is the fact that, yes, he loses all these abilities to do stuff little by little, and he doesn't know when it's all going to happen. But the fact that his mind is still clear, so he's aware of all this stuff, and yet he can't do anything about it.
Right. So, I mean, a lot of people don't know what Huntington's is. That's one of the reasons I chose that topic next, is I was hoping that the readers who are now sort of loyal readers will pick up whatever I write next and will learn a bit about a disease they might not be familiar with. So Huntington's, the primary symptom it has to do with movement. And so it affects the part of your brain involved in planning movement. So you lose control over your ability to voluntarily control movement. So if I go to pick up a glass of water, I might knock it over, or I might pick it up and then drop it. I'll have trouble walking. I'll have trouble talking because your tongue is a muscle and you might slur your words. Eventually you can't walk at all, speak at all, feed yourself. And so that's the movement piece. There's a lot of involuntary movement too. That's called the chorea. You might have heard of, it used to be called Huntington's chorea. Chorea is Greek for dance. So there's a lot of uncontrollable involuntary movement. So people are sort of moving around a lot, swinging arms and falling down a bit. So that's a movement piece, but then there are other aspects too. There's psychiatric and cognitive components. So if you have this, you are likely to also have obsessive compulsive disorder, rage, paranoia, depression, apathy. You might have dysexecutive syndrome and some memory impairment, slightly different than Alzheimer's, but more sort of implicit procedural memory impairment. But you're right, your intellect is intact, you know everyone, you recognize everyone, your memory of your life stays intact. So in some ways it's like ALS in that respect. It's been described as a combination of, and this is, you know, it's not entirely accurate, but it's been described as a combination of ALS, Alzheimer's, and schizophrenia. So it's a brutal, brutal disease. And it's 100% genetic all of the time. The only thing that causes it is a genetic mutation, and it's dominantly inherited, which means if your mom or dad has this, you have a 50-50 chance of getting it.
We're visiting with Lisa Genova. Lisa Genova is New York Times bestselling author. Her books include Left Neglected, Love Anthony, Still Alice, and the most current is Inside the O'Briens, which deals with a blue-collar family in Boston suburb, dealing with Huntington's disease. As you mentioned, not very many people are familiar with Huntington's disease. How did you choose this disease? Do you have someone you know close to you who perhaps has been touched by this, or how did you go about writing this, Lisa?
So I was 22 years old. It was my first job out of college. I was working in Massachusetts General East in the Charlestown Navy Yard, doing research on drug addiction. I was a lab technician. And it was February of 93 when the lab down the hall, and you could, all the labs were sort of continuous. There are no doors between them. So I could see this group of scientists, neuroscientists down the hall. They start celebrating. And word started to travel as to what was going on, and I learned that they had just isolated the genetic mutation that causes Huntington's disease. And I remember getting really still and getting the goosebumps and knowing that I was witnessing a historic moment in all of science and thinking, my God, they're going to cure this disease. Because I knew that this was the only thing that causes Huntington's, and these scientists had just discovered it. And we are 22 years later, and there is still no treatment and no cure. And part of the reason is because it's very difficult to go from understanding a genetic code that causes the disease to coming up with a pharmaceutical that will treat the product of that mistake in the genetic code. And yet, you know, that's tough, but we've had 22 years. I'm surprised that we haven't come up with something. And so the other part of the reason is that, so for example, we have 5.2 million Americans who have Alzheimer's, and there are just about 30,000 people in the U.S. who have Huntington's. So if you're a drug company, where are you placing your investment?
Yes.
Right. So it's called an orphan disease because there are so few people that have it relatively. And yet, you know, 30,000 people, if 30,000 Americans were being held hostage somewhere, you know, the government would spend millions and millions to rescue them. And so this is not an insignificant number of people. This is a disease that urgently needs our attention. It is devastating to families. It just, you know, because of its genetic component, you can have three generations within a family all dealing with Huntington's disease at the same time. So I wrote this book because I wanted to raise awareness about a disease that people know little about.
As far as raising the awareness, as you mentioned earlier, it is it can be passed on, 50-50 chance that your children will inherit this. And so there's a part in the book also where you're waiting to see what's going to happen. Are these children going to be tested? And they're, of course, they're grown children, but you're wondering, what about the couple who just had a baby or is going to have a baby? And what about the future? And Joe, again, feels very responsible for all this. And as you mentioned earlier, he's a policeman. He's used to having things in order. He's the one who kind of gets things under control because of he's a policeman. And now he feels like he himself has been handcuffed to his own job at home.
Right. And, you know, so, you know, the research for this book was extensive. I spent a lot of time with police officers. I was in touch with a Boston police officer every day for the year that I was writing this book. Came to know families with Huntington's. I spent a lot of time in Charlestown. And I also came to know, and I grew up in Waltham, Massachusetts, which isn't far from Boston. And when I was growing up, most people in that town were either Irish or Italian. And I'm Italian, but I have a lot of friends of Irish heritage. And I spoke with them a lot to get some details about what the traditions and sort of what does being Irish mean to them. And it's fascinating because, you know, I also grew up Catholic, but I guess the Roman Catholic Church is slightly different than the Irish Catholics in that we didn't grow up with the guilt. But the Irish guilt is there and is a big deal. And so for Joe O'Brien, who has just maybe passed on this gene, you know, each kid has a 50-50 chance, so they could all get it. The guilt is really tough to deal with of what he may have done to his kids. He feels so responsible.
I like the fact.
The book,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
The book is also told in his youngest daughter's point of view, so Katie, who's 21. And you're right, each kid has to wrestle with the question of, do I want to know? So because of that discovery in February of 93 in the Charlestown Navy Yard, there is now a blood test, that a simple blood test that anyone at risk can take to find out if they have the genetic mutation that causes Huntington's. So each of these kids in their 20s has to decide if they want to know approximately how and when they might get this disease, which is fatal. It kills you within 10 to 20 years.
And one of the things that I think you know, people can relate to when you're reading the book, as you mentioned, it's a blue-collar family from one of the suburbs of Boston. But I like it when they have their Sunday dinners and they don't know what they're going to have, but also the fact that they're drinking out of jelly jars. They have mismatched plates. They have wine. They have Kool-Aid. They have tea. They can't have beer until after they've eaten. And it's just a really neat it makes you feel like you're part of an everyday family, and it's not somebody who has fine china. You know, they're going to eat out at a fancy restaurant. This is something that every average American can relate to.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, again, I really enjoyed writing with family. It felt very much like going home for me. Growing up in Waltham, very blue-collar town, everybody's Irish or Italian for the most part. So I really, connected with this family easily, and they felt real to me as well.
And a lot of the novels that have been set in, say, the 1940s, or like, for example, A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, or some of the other books like that, they feature Irish police officers, and the majority of the police officers in the police force in New York and Boston, wherever, are Irish. And you're right as far as the Irish and the Italians, even though there are different ways of doing things, there is that religion that ties them together, the Roman Catholicism. However, it's very different, as you mentioned, between Irish Catholic and Roman Catholic. And in this book, Joe kind of follows along with what his wife does as far as the holy water, and then the statue of the Virgin that I think, I don't remember if eventually it falls mishap to one of his episodes or not. But another thing that the children are aware of is Joe's temper. And some people will say, well, you know, it's traditional, stereotypical that Irish people have a temper. But this is something different. And it's a Joe fighting with he's used to fighting with bad guys as a police officer. But the bad guy is inside himself.
Right. And so for Joe, the temper and the rage, the outbursts really do have to do with the disease and are not characteristic of his normal temperament. And this is talked about with Rosie, that he's, you know, with the doctor, she admits, you know, he's had this sort of weird temper for the past 6 to 7 years. And, you know, some of it is a neurobiological symptom of the disease, and some of it is what you just mentioned, is him just raging against what's going on inside him that he does not have control over, and the frustration over his inability to do the things he used to do.
And I don't remember, please remind me, one of the daughter who has quotes all over her wall.
That's Katie.
Okay, Katie. So Katie, at one point, decides to, in her anger, get rid of all these quotes. And then her dad tells her, you know, it's those quotes that kind of keep me going sometimes. And then at the beginning of the book, you even have a quote by Joe. And let me see if I can find it real quick. Something about, once you imagine, you can't unimagine it. Oh, once you imagine these things, you can't unimagine them. Joe O'Brien. And so the quotes that Katie goes by and reads, and the reader follows them, they take on a very deep meaning for the family and for the reader.
Thanks. Yeah, so Katie is a 21-year-old yoga teacher, and part of sort of a yogi life has to do with a lot of getting, quieting the mental chatter in your mind that is usually running on somewhat of a negative playlist. It's sort of, you know, if you're driving in your car, you're sitting, you know, in your house or whatever it is that you're doing, even if you're practicing yoga, you're on your yoga mat, you may find that your mind is actually very busy chatting on and on about, like, what you have to do next or reliving some difficult thing that went on 7 years ago that you're still upset about. And it's very difficult for us as human beings to quiet that chatter. And the quotes have a lot to do with reminding you to live the positive spiritual life that the tenets of yoga speak to. And so Katie has quotes on her walls by Buddha and Eckhart Tolle and Baron Baptiste as sort of, you know, visual reminders of the way she wants to live. And you know, the family sort of teases her a lot in the beginning of the story about her yoga because it's become a bit of a religion to her. And you're right, as the story moves on, a lot of what Katie has learned and is practicing in her yoga life it becomes some of the tools that help her and her father deal with Huntington's.
We are visiting with Lisa Genova. She is the award-winning author, New York Times bestselling author of the book Still Alice, Left Neglected, Love Anthony, and the most recent is Inside the O'Briens, which deals with Huntington's disease. And Lisa, just like your other books, in addition to having book signings, in addition to selling your book, you also are very involved in helping the cause. And the same thing for this book. Each book that you sell, I think, is going to help somebody. And you have a website that people can go to find out more about Huntington's disease and also how they can help. Would you mind sharing that with us?
Yeah, thank you so much. So at the end of this book, I've created something called a call to action, asking the readers to be readers in action. So if you've read the book and you found the story entertaining and you learned a little bit about Huntington and you feel a compassionate awareness for families going through this, I'm asking the readers to get involved. And, you know, I'm also talking with readers a lot about how, you know, whatever your investment was in this book, maybe you didn't even buy the book. Maybe, you know, your mom loaned you her copy, or you took the book out from the library, or you got it at discount on Amazon. However you've come to get this book, I'm asking you to make an additional investment. Go to lisagenova.com, click on the Readers in Action button, and that will take you to a page that has to do with Inside the O'Briens and Fenway Park, and there's sort of a neat animation that speaks to the number of people in the U.S. with Huntington's, and asking each reader to donate something to the HD Human Biology Project. This is a series of clinical trials aimed at understanding the biology of Huntington's disease as it occurs in humans so that we can get to the cure. And, you know, over 2 million people have bought Still Alice in the U.S. And they've all, you know, people share books. So, you know, I don't know how many people have read that story. But if everyone who read Still Alice had donated even $1 to the Alzheimer's Association, and if they had donated $10 to the Alzheimer's Association, it would be a huge impact on research. So I wanted to create that right from the beginning with this story. And so the readers in action will have a chance to contribute $10 or $20 or whatever you can. And as a readership, we can keep track of what we have generated collectively. Because I think together we could do something that would have a major impact on getting us toward the progress we need to see to get to the cure for Huntington.
Lisa, thank you very much for taking the time to be with us here today. We've been visiting with award-winning New York Times bestselling author Lisa Genova. She is the author of the recent book, Inside the O'Briens. And if you go to lisagenova.com, you can find out more about Readers in Action and some of the other things that perhaps we didn't touch upon as deeply as we should have.